Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the OES podcast. I'm your host, Hassan Muslimani, and I'm head of carbon management research here at the Institute. And I'm joined today by Dr. Malika Shalabi, who is senior carbon pricing policy and advocacy advisor at Shell, but he's also a visiting research fellow here at the OES. Today, we'll be discussing some key issues in carbon markets while also reflecting on the outcomes of COP28, which took place in Dubai last December. I'd also like to point out that Malik has recently published an article with us entitled How Can Carbon Trading Unlock Carbon Dioxide Removals, or what we will be referring to moving forward in this podcast as CDR. But before we do that, and to timestamp this discussion, we're recording this on the afternoon of February the 16th. Malik, thanks for joining us today, and welcome to the OES podcast series.
Thank you, Hassan. It's great to be here, and it's a privilege to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Malik, perhaps we can start with some scene setting, yeah? You and I had met in Dubai, and having spoken with many of the experts who were there are some, if I may call them, mixed feelings about the outcomes of the conference, especially in relation to carbon markets. So what is your take on what happened there?
Thanks, Hassan, and a great question. And I think if we take a step back and look at the broader perspective, I think if we look at the UAE consensus and the progress made on loss and damage, the COP process is very much alive, and the UAE presidency should be congratulated on all that they managed to achieve. COP28, held in the UAE in December of last year, progressed many aspects of the international climate negotiations. This includes the first reference to transitioning away from fossil fuels, operationalization to the loss and damage fund, and many other milestones in the UAE consensus. However, on carbon markets, there was a little bit less progress than we would have expected.
I'm glad we're starting off with a positive note regarding the overall achievements of COP28. But in focus on carbon markets specifically, what major developments did you see happen in Dubai?
Yeah, so I think if we take a look at the World Bank, if we look back 30 years, the first carbon prices were implemented in the 1990s. And if we fast forward to today, there are approximately 70 carbon pricing initiatives covering around 25% of the world's emissions, which represents a sizable improvement. But that still means that 75% of emissions are still unpriced, and more needs to be done in this space. So given that context, carbon pricing announcements featured heavily around COP28. This includes the Global Carbon Pricing Challenge, an initiative from the Government of Canada for carbon pricing to cover 60% of global emissions by 2030, compared to 25% today. The EU also called for advanced global cooperation on carbon pricing with the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. And carbon pricing is very much seen as a key policy lever for net zero emissions by the four organizations, which underlined the importance of carbon pricing for the climate and for a fair transition. Additionally, you saw other national-based announcements where the UAE approved a national carbon registry, and many, many others. However, negotiators failed to agree specific issues related to Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which is one of the foundational elements of a broader international carbon trading mechanism, and by implication, a catalyst for wider adoption of carbon pricing. And parties could not agree to provisions relating to Article 6.2 or Article 6.4, despite lengthy consultations in the lead-up to COP28, and many nights of long deliberations throughout the COP.
Indeed, Article 6 was the buzzword around town. We had been very hopeful the issues surrounding the article would finally be resolved and that the mechanism would become operational. But it seems that that was the mechanism that took the biggest hit at COP. So what happened there?
Yeah, so I think for background and maybe for those that are less familiar with Article 6, if we look at a recent report by the University of Maryland and AIITA, Article 6.2 allows countries to set up bilateral or plurilateral arrangements for trading of emission reductions or removals, referred to as ITMOs, or internationally transferred mitigation outcomes. Article 6.4 could create a generic carbon market similar in character to the Clean Development Mechanism, or CDM, under the Kyoto Protocol, in which projects can be registered to create ITMOs under the supervision of the UNFCCC. And the goal of Article 6 really is to enable parties to do more than they would have been able to do so had they implemented their nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, independently. And that's what Article 6 is really about, providing an opportunity to develop a global UN-led carbon market. But the politicization of markets was on full display and did not foster the spirit of what was needed to progress the international carbon market agenda, which was disappointing as other obstacles had been overcome, as we highlighted earlier. And if we go into a little bit of the detail, if we look at IETA's COP28 summary, which I have the privilege to co-chair the International Working Group, on Article 6.2, the EU, the Latin American and Caribbean Alliance, also known as ILAC, and the Alliance of Small Island States, also known as EOSIS, pushed for more oversight on these party-to-party agreements, while the umbrella group, which includes the US, the UK, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, and the like-minded developing countries, also known as the NMDCs, which includes China, India, and Saudi Arabia, opposed because they believe that the bilateral nature of Article 6.2 meant that it should be managed by parties engaging in the bilateral trades and not by another authority. This difference could not be resolved in the negotiating room despite apparent clarity in the Article 6.2 rulebook, where there's a statement to the effect of guidance will not infringe on the NDC nature of the contribution. So that was on 6.2. On 6.4, another set of differences emerged across a variety of topics, including removals, methodologies, and registries. Notably, the supervisory body had worked on recommendations for removals and methodologies throughout the year and agreed drafts for both. However, at COP28, the EU and Coalition for Rainforest Nations expressed strong opposition to the removals recommendation while willing to accept the methodologies paper. However, the LMDCs and others were not willing to progress one recommendation and not the other, which could not be overcome as many believed they needed to be adopted together. And differences also emerged on how registries would interact with countries unable to find compromise. And really, we left COP28 without an update to the rules.
Thanks, Malik. That's a great overview of 6.2 and 6.4. And for the benefit of our listeners, we're actually going to be speaking to IETA in a future episode of the podcast, so do look out for that. But perhaps we can now shift the focus and the discussion a bit towards carbon removal, because it has been such a hot topic at COP and afterwards. It is an area that took center stage back then, but it's also one that we're very much interested in. And it is no secret that there is now a strong policy focus towards CDR. But also, there's a lot of movement in the market on the supply and demand side, with many corporates focusing on purchasing CDR specifically. So why is carbon pricing, and how can carbon markets be important for CDR and for net zero?
I think if we look at the paper that was referenced earlier, carbon trading has long been identified as a key tool as part of a broader policy framework to help achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement. Not all countries will have the same access to or capacity to develop these CDRs. And this is where trade becomes relevant. As an example, Singapore is a nation that has announced a mid-century net zero target, but has limited CDR capacity, whether engineered or natural. And in such an instance, in order to achieve net zero, carbon trading with partners in other host countries will be required. And specifically, while Singapore invests in a trade partner's CDR, again, whether it's engineered or natural, the trade partner, through the investment, is able to create jobs and support their local economy while contributing towards Singapore's NDC, where credits are correspondingly adjusted and double counting is avoided. On a higher level, this allows countries to explore and invest in projects with the lowest cost of abatement while creating opportunities for both parties, as highlighted also in some of the work that we've done in our Singapore scenario sketch. And as a consequence, we have three policy recommendations that we identified in the OIES paper. The first is to recognize that not all CDRs are distributed equally. Trading of CDRs will help alleviate consequences of this uneven distribution. and should as such be identified as one of the key levers to achieve decarbonization. This includes recognizing that country-to-country carbon trading is required to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, including emphasizing the role of Article 6. Secondly, for CDRs to be deployed at scale, technological advances in digital infrastructure and trading platforms has an integral role to play to improve their integration within carbon markets. And the final note is with regards to integrated capacity building across governments, private sector, NGOs, and relevant stakeholders. The ongoing energy transition differentiates itself from previous transitions in that it will be actively managed, and greater understanding and integration across sectors and participants will be required. This entails governments to establish frameworks with input from all the relevant sectors, including the private sector, academia, and customers, to ensure that carbon trading platforms are operating in a framework that helps achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement in the most effective manner.
So CDR and net zero strategies, could you give an example of how this could be part of a broader policy framework?
I think if we take a look at the UAE scenario sketch, which was done in collaboration with the UAE Ministry of Energy and Infrastructure, it draws on insights from Shell's own energy security scenarios, which were published last year. The energy security scenarios explore two possible futures, called Archipelagos and Sky 2050, that could emerge out of recent global events. In Sky 2050, mutual interest prevails and the world achieves extraordinary progress and change in the energy system as it speeds towards net zero emissions. This not only enables acceleration in the UAE, but creates a hub and a huge opportunity for the nation as a major clean energy hub. But the global and regional dynamics could slow progress, on the other hand, which we explore in the other scenario that we call Archipelagos. And in that scenario, nations seek local energy solutions to protect competitiveness and increase self-sufficiency, with decarbonization as a secondary concern. Trade, mineral availability, and protectionism all lead to slower global and local decarbonization efforts. And avoiding the pitfalls within archipelagos is the challenge of our times. And the UAE scenario sketch explores in depth what these two possible futures could mean for the UAE on a sector-by-sector basis. The UAE currently emits around 200 million tons of CO2 per year, and it will need to invest the equivalent of 2-3% of GDP in both supply and demand side of its energy system to reach net zero emissions by 2050. And this will require policies to promote investment in renewables, low carbon fuels, and power infrastructure upgrades. And potential policy options to achieve these include transformation in aviation and marine, transport, buildings, industry, and energy production. And what this means, for example, in industry, is through efficiency measures, fuel switching, and carbon capture and storage. On transport, through electrification and the use of electric vehicles. On buildings, efficiency improvements and demand-side management programs. And on energy production, through solar power generation and the use of low-carbon fuels. And what's important to realize is that the remaining residual emissions, after all these levers have been pulled, can be compensated through and in accordance with Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. Article 6 enables the UAE to build the markets that it will deepen, that it will depend on to become a recognized hub for carbon trading. And this could include trade with countries in the region or beyond. And the UAE's deep experience in trading means it could help pioneer carbon trading in the region as a means to achieving net zero.
Thanks, Malik. Investing 2-3% of GDP, as you mentioned, this is a big task, obviously. And do you see any specific technologies leading the way? Obviously, you mentioned a lot of solutions, but are there specific technologies that would help the UAE context, but also globally to get there?
Yeah, I think if we take a look at the technologies out there, and maybe one example of a country that's done this well is Switzerland, where they have looked at their marginal abatement cost and they've seen substitutes across their economy sector by sector. And one of the areas that they felt couldn't be avoided and where residual emissions existed is in the transport sector. And the Click Foundation in Switzerland really looks at using those residual emissions to be compensated through Article 6. And there's been many agreements with Ghana, which we discussed on another podcast last year, that allows for that trade and allows for that investment to help Ghana develop its local economy, while also Switzerland achieving its net zero targets. And so a lot of these will be country-specific contexts where they may or may not have the opportunity to look at appropriate technologies. But I think across the board, the trading of carbon remains one of the key policy levers that can help deploy those relevant technologies while achieving net zero.
Thanks, Malik. So I'm very appreciative of your very optimistic view as opposed to a lot of the people that I've spoken to post-COP. So this is very refreshing. On a more higher level, what is your outlook for carbon markets in the year ahead, or what are you expecting to see in 2024?
On 2024 in carbon markets, I think bringing Article 6 to full operational status is required now more than ever. But it's important to recognize that next year, 2025, will mark a decade since the Paris Agreement's inception, and the world is still unlikely to have an operational Article 6.4 mechanism by then. And maybe, you know, shifting from the positive to the realistic, 10 years to deliver a working outcome from a key provision of the Paris Agreement is challenging, particularly when we know that the limited remaining carbon budget is now counted in single years and not in decades. And as confidence in the COP process with regards to carbon markets specifically continues to waver, market players may look elsewhere to close the gap, such as making even more use of a voluntary carbon market. And this might offer some hope and cause for optimism, but it is also hard to see the voluntary carbon market doing the heavy lifting that's required to get the world to net zero emissions by 2050. As argued previously, without a functioning Article 6, net zero emissions might not be achieved at all in the desired time frame, which showcases the importance and relevance that it has today. You know, a final note, putting a direct price on carbon emissions as part of a broader policy framework to achieve net zero emissions is key. Whether it's a tax or a cap and trade or a hybrid, applying it to many sectors of the economy and increasing it over time has shown to be a key lever in helping countries and regions decarbonize. And the hope is that that will continue to grow in 2024 alongside the developments of Article 6.
Malik, this is such an interesting topic, and I'm sure we'll continue this offline. But unfortunately, this is all we have time for today. Thank you so much for your time and insights. For the benefit of our listeners, and as I already mentioned, Malik's paper, our paper actually, is on our website. And the title again is How Carbon Markets Can Unlock CDR. With that, I'd also like to thank you, our listeners, for joining us. I'd like to mention that as part of the carbon management work, which we're doing here at the Institute, we're looking closely at carbon markets, both compliance and voluntary. So do look out for our publications. And as always, we welcome your feedback and we look forward to having you on future episodes of the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.